In a world that never stops evolving, Anton Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard remains hauntingly relevant more than a century after its 1904 premiere. This masterpiece about a family facing the loss of their beloved estate has captivated audiences worldwide, from Broadway to Tokyo, becoming one of the most frequently performed plays in the theatrical canon. Meryl Streep once called it the perfect play after her portrayal of Ranevskaya, while director Peter Brook described it as a perfect balance between laughter and tears. What makes this Russian playwright's final work so enduring? Perhaps it's how Chekhov captured that universal moment when we must choose between clinging to our past or embracing an uncertain future. As the sound of axes cutting down cherry trees echoes through the final scene, we're left with a profound meditation on change that feels as personal today as it did to audiences in pre-revolutionary Russia. The curtain rises on a cold May morning in early 20th century Russia, during a period of profound social and economic transformation. The cherry trees are in bloom, casting their ethereal white glow across the estate, their delicate petals drifting like snow in the crisp spring air. Lopahin, a wealthy merchant whose grandfather and father once worked as serfs on this very estate, waits anxiously at the train station. He's there to greet Lyubov Andreyevna Ranevskaya, the estate owner who fled to Paris 5 years earlier after the drowning of her young son Grisha in the nearby river, a tragedy that still haunts the family. With her returns her brother Gayev, known for his frivolous speeches and addiction to expensive candies, her 17-year-old daughter Anya, her adopted daughter Varya, who manages the estate, and an entourage of servants, including the elderly Furs, whose own life spans the momentous transition from serfdom to freedom. The estate they return to exists in a complex duality, both paradise and prison, sanctuary and burden. The cherry orchard itself stands as a masterpiece of natural beauty, the largest in the region, its white blossoms visible for miles around, creating an almost mythical landscape that has defined the region for generations. The family home, a grand structure filled with antique furniture and fading portraits, holds layers of memories, children's laughter, elegant parties, whispered secrets, and the echoes of a more prosperous era. Yet beneath this facade of genteel beauty lies crushing financial ruin. The estate is heavily mortgaged, with payments long overdue and an auction date looming just months away. Lopahin, representing the new merchant class, immediately presents his solution: cut down the cherry orchard and build summer cottages for wealthy vacationers, a plan that would subdivide the historic estate into profitable parcels. It's practical, profitable, and utterly unthinkable to Ranevskaya and Gayev, who see the orchard as the embodiment of their family's noble history and their own identities as aristocrats. This opening act masterfully establishes the central tension that will drive the play forward, the collision between sentiment and practicality, between aristocratic values and commercial interests, between the dying world of the nobility and the rising middle class. When Ranevskaya gazes out the window at the moonlit orchard and imagines seeing her dead mother walking among the trees, wearing a white dress, we understand why she cannot bring herself to destroy something so deeply intertwined with her personal and family history. Yet when Lopahin repeatedly warns, "You must decide," punctuating his practical advice with increasingly urgent deadlines, we sense the inexorable pressure of economic reality bearing down on this family's dreamy nostalgia. The cherry orchard itself becomes a character, silent but ever-present, visible through windows, referenced in every conversation, its shadow falling across every scene. Its fate hangs in the balance as the human characters dance around the decisions they can't bring themselves to make, each blossom a reminder of both beauty and impermanence. The orchard serves as both mirror and metaphor for the larger social changes sweeping through Russia, where ancient traditions and modern necessities clash in an unprecedented era of transformation. The Ranevsky family stands as a poignant embodiment of the dying Russian aristocrats, their story unfolding with painful authenticity against the backdrop of sweeping social change. Lyuba Andreevna Renevskaya emerges as a fascinating contradiction, generous to a fault, giving away gold coins even as bankruptcy looms, yet utterly incapable of practical management. She's charming, cultured, and completely unprepared for the economic realities of modern Russia. Her extravagant habits persist despite their ruinous consequences. She maintains an expensive apartment in Paris, continues to employ a full staff she can't afford, and hosts lavish parties with imported delicacies. When she receives a telegram from her lover in Paris, who has abandoned and robbed her, she tears it up, but cannot stop herself from sending money she doesn't have, demonstrating the deep-seated patterns that have led to her financial ruin. Her brother Leonid Gayev mirrors this impracticality with his own peculiar behaviors. A middle-aged man who still speaks to furniture affectionately, he particularly dotes on an ancient bookcase, delivering emotional speeches to it as if it were a beloved family member. He constantly makes imaginary billiard shots when conversation becomes uncomfortable, announcing "yellow ball in the corner pocket" at inappropriate moments, retreating into childhood games rather than facing adult responsibilities. His proposed solutions to their financial crisis reveal a profound disconnection from reality, suggesting borrowing from wealthy acquaintances who are themselves nearly bankrupt, or expecting their ancient great-aunt to rescue them despite her well-known distaste for Renevskaya's lifestyle. He spends his days eating expensive candies and reminiscing about the family's glorious past while their present crumbles around them. The family's disconnect from reality reaches its tragic crescendo when they host an elaborate party on the very evening of the auction that will determine their fate. The scene is rife with painful irony. Champagne flows freely while their ancestral home is being sold to pay their debts. Rather than attending the auction themselves, they send Gayev and Lopakhin while continuing their festivities, as if ignoring the problem might somehow make it disappear. The guests dance and celebrate, oblivious to the family's impending doom. When Lopakhin returns with news that he himself has purchased the estate, Renevskaya collapses in tears while the band continues playing dance music in the next room, creating a devastating juxtaposition of revelry and despair. What makes these characters so compelling is that Chekhov never reduces them to mere caricatures of aristocratic decline. Despite their flaws, we feel genuine affection for them, understanding their human complexity. Renevskaya's grief over her drowned son Grisha manifests in her inability to face the cherry orchard where he died, explaining much of her erratic behavior and extended absences. Gayev, for all his childishness, genuinely loves his sister and nieces, attempting to protect them even as he fails to grasp the severity of their situation. They are human beings caught in historical currents beyond their control, aristocrats who never learned to swim in the rising tide of capitalism that would eventually sweep away their entire class. Their personal tragedies become emblematic of a larger social transformation as the old order gives way to the new with both inevitability and profound human cost. Standing in stark contrast to the fading aristocracy are the representatives of Russia's future. Lopakhin, the successful merchant, whose grandfather was a serf on this very estate, embodies the rising commercial class. He's hardworking, practical, and unsentimental about business matters, representing the new breed of self-made men emerging in late 19th century Russia. Yet his relationship with the Renevsky family is complex. He clearly admires and even loves them, particularly Renevskaya, who once showed kindness to him as a child, tending to his bloodied nose after his father had struck him. When he purchases their estate, his triumph is tinged with genuine regret, revealing the emotional complexity beneath his businessman's exterior. "I bought the estate where my grandfather and father were slaves, where they weren't even allowed in the kitchen," he exclaims in his moment of victory, dancing maniacally around the room. His purchase represents both personal vindication and historical justice. The grandson of serfs now owns the land his ancestors worked. Yet he immediately feels uncomfortable in the drawing room, knocking over a candelabra and apologizing awkwardly, his novo-rich status apparent in every gesture. For all his wealth, he still feels like an outsider in aristocratic spaces, unable to fully inhabit the role of master despite his economic power. His plans to subdivide the cherry orchard into summer cottages reflect both his practical business sense and his inability to appreciate the estate's cultural significance. Representing another vision of Russia's future is Petya Trofimov, the eternal student and revolutionary idealist. Where Lopakhin sees profit, Trofimov sees social justice and the need for radical change. He delivers passionate speeches about Russia's need to work and atone for its past sins of serfdom, speaking with the fervor of the emerging intelligentsia. "All of Russia is our orchard," he tells Anya, inspiring her with visions of a more equitable society. His relationship with Anya represents the alliance between idealistic youth and progressive thinking, though their romance remains notably platonic. Yet Trofimov himself is somewhat ridiculous, perpetually broke, unable to complete his studies after 8 years at university, and too idealistic to function effectively in the real world. His character prefigures the revolutionary intellectuals who would later shape Russia's destiny, combining genuine insight with impractical utopianism. Between these competing visions of Russia's future, Lopakhin's pragmatic capitalism and Trofimov's utopian socialism, the play presents no clear winner. Lopakhin may have purchased the orchard, but he seems uncertain what to do with his victory, standing alone in the empty house after his triumph. His planned development represents progress, but also destruction, mirroring Russia's painful modernization. Trofimov's ideas inspire the young, but offer no practical solutions to immediate problems, highlighting the gap between revolutionary theory and economic reality. Both men represent incomplete answers to Russia's transition from feudalism to modernity, foreshadowing the tumultuous decades to come in Russian history. Their contrasting characters embody the fundamental tensions that would eventually lead to the Russian Revolution, the conflict between economic modernization and social justice, between practical progress and idealistic transformation. Against the backdrop of sweeping social change in pre-revolutionary Russia, Chekhov masterfully interweaves several poignant love stories that never quite reach fulfillment. Most prominent among these is the complex relationship between Lopakhin, the successful merchant, and Varya, Ranevskaya's adopted daughter. Their potential union hangs over the entire play like an unspoken promise. Everyone expects them to marry. They clearly harbor deep feelings for each other, and such a marriage would elegantly resolve both financial and social complications. Yet something intangible but powerful prevents Lopakhin from proposing, despite numerous carefully orchestrated opportunities. The culmination of their unfulfilled romance comes in their final scene together, a masterpiece of subtle theatrical tension. With Varya packing her belongings to leave the estate forever, Lopakhin enters the room with clear intention to propose. What follows is an excruciating dance of avoidance. They engage in painfully awkward small talk about the weather, her future plans working as a housekeeper, and trivial matters of luggage. The air is thick with unspoken words and suppressed emotions. Just when it seems Lopakhin might finally break through his own barriers and speak his heart, he's called away on business and exits with a rushed goodbye, leaving both characters and audience with a profound sense of loss and missed opportunity. The play is riddled with similarly thwarted romantic connections. Dunyasha, the romantic young maid, desperately pines for Yasha, Ranevskaya's sophisticated valet. Her genuine affection is met with casual cruelty as Yasha dismisses her feelings while dreaming of returning to the glamour of Paris. The contrast between her sincere provincial love and his worldly ambitions creates a miniature tragedy of its own. Meanwhile, the perpetually unlucky clerk Yepy Hodov, nicknamed 22 Misfortunes for his constant accidents and misfortunes, pursues Dunyasha with clumsy determination, despite her obvious lack of interest. His persistent courtship becomes both comic relief and a reflection of the play's broader themes of misaligned desires. The relationship between Anya, Ranevskaya's young daughter, and the eternal student Trofimov adds another layer of complexity. Their connection hovers in an ambiguous space between romantic attraction and intellectual partnership. Trofimov insists they must rise above love, focusing instead on their vision for Russia's future. This sublimation of personal desire into political ideology represents a different kind of unfulfilled romance, one sacrificed on the altar of social progress. These various unfulfilled relationships serve as powerful metaphors for the larger themes of missed connections and failed communications that permeate the play. Characters repeatedly talk past each other, retreat into self-absorbed monologues, or remain frustratingly silent when words are most crucial. The inability to connect on a personal level reflects the deeper social divisions that prevent Russia from moving forward as a cohesive society. When Lopakhin cannot bring himself to propose to Varya despite genuine affection, we see how deeply ingrained class barriers remain even as economic realities shift. The personal and the political become inextricably intertwined, each failed romance echoing the larger tragedy of a society unable to bridge its fundamental divisions. Memory functions as both blessing and curse throughout the Cherry Orchard. For Ranovskaya, the orchard represents her idyllic childhood. She sees her dead mother walking among the trees and remembers playing there as a girl. These memories provide comfort, but also prevent her from taking necessary action. "If only I could forget my past," she laments at one point, recognizing how her attachment to memory paralyzes her. The elderly servant Furs embodies memory at its most poignant. At 87, he constantly reminisces about life before the emancipation of the serfs, which he views as a disaster rather than liberation. "The peasants belonged to the masters, and the masters belonged to the peasants," he repeats, idealizing a feudal system that at least provided structure and mutual obligation. His loyalty to the family transcends economic relationships. He serves them because his identity is inseparable from theirs. Memory takes physical form in the cherry orchard itself. When Lopakhin proposes cutting it down, he's not merely suggesting a business transaction, but the erasure of history. The orchard has witnessed generations of births, deaths, celebrations, and sorrows. Its destruction represents a definitive break with the past that Ranovskaya and Gayev cannot bear to contemplate. Yet clinging to these memories prevents them from creating new ones. The play suggests that healthy engagement with memory involves selective preservation rather than wholesale attachment or rejection. Anya, the youngest character, points toward this possibility when she comforts her mother after the sale. "We'll plant a new garden, more splendid than this one." She honors the past without being imprisoned by it, recognizing that memory can inspire future creation rather than just mourning what's lost. In one of the play's most haunting moments, characters hear a distant sound like a breaking string, followed by silence. This mysterious sound, perhaps a broken cable in a mine shaft, perhaps something more metaphysical, represents the severing of connections to the past, a break in the continuity of Russian history that can never be repaired. While the fate of the aristocratic family drives the main plot, Chekhov gives remarkable attention to the servants, whose lives are equally disrupted by the estate sale. Each servant represents a different response to Russia's changing social order. Furs, the elderly manservant, clings to pre-emancipation values, preferring the security of serfdom to the uncertainties of freedom. When the family accidentally leaves him behind in the empty house, his abandonment symbolizes how the old order discards those who served it most faithfully. Yasha, the young valet, represents the opposite extreme, eager to escape Russia for the sophistication of Paris, embarrassed by his rural origins, and contemptuous of his fellow servants. "The peasants are all alike," he remarks dismissively, "ignorant as pigs." His ambition lacks any moral foundation. He simply wants to attach himself to wealth and status wherever he can find it. Between these extremes stands Dunyasha, the housemaid who affects aristocratic airs while remaining fundamentally insecure about her position. She uses perfume and wears fashionable corsets, prompting Yasha to mock her. "A peasant girl shouldn't put on such airs." Her attempts to elevate herself socially through romance prove futile as she pursues the indifferent Yasha while rejecting the devoted Yepikodov. Perhaps most intriguing is Charlotta, the governess and amateur magician whose uncertain origins place her outside Russia's rigid class system entirely. "I don't know who my parents were," she confesses in a rare moment of vulnerability. "Who I am, why I exist, I have no idea." Her magic tricks and ventriloquism serve as metaphors for the performative nature of class identity. She creates illusions that momentarily transcend social boundaries. Through these characters, Chekhov explores how social change affects not just the wealthy, but everyone connected to them. When the estate changes hands, an entire ecosystem of relationships is disrupted. The servants face uncertain futures just as their employers do, but with fewer resources and safety nets. Their struggles remind us that major historical transitions create ripple effects through all levels of society. Throughout the play, characters resist acknowledging the inevitable loss of the cherry orchard despite overwhelming evidence. Lopakhin repeatedly presents his plan for summer cottages as the only viable solution, yet Renovskaya and Gaev continually change the subject, retreat into memories, or propose fantastical alternatives. This pattern of avoidance in the face of inescapable change gives the play its tragic dimension. If there's one thing in this whole world that's interesting, remarkable even, it's our cherry orchard, Gaev declares, as if aesthetic value could somehow overcome economic reality. Renovskaya similarly treats the auction date as a vague future event rather than an imminent deadline. When Lopakhin asks if they've decided about the cottages, she distracts herself by ordering tea or reminiscing about her childhood. These evasions reflect a deeply human tendency to deny uncomfortable truths until they become impossible to ignore. The inevitability of change is represented most powerfully by the sound of the axe in the play's final moments. After the family has departed, leaving the confused furs behind, we hear the distant thud of axes striking cherry trees. This sound, described in the stage directions as sad and lonely, communicates more effectively than any speech could the finality of what has occurred. The orchard that has stood for generations will be gone within hours, regardless of how deeply it was loved or what memories it contained. Yet alongside this inevitability runs a current of resistance that gives the characters their dignity. Even knowing they cannot win, they assert their values against market forces. When Lopakhin celebrates purchasing the orchard, Renovskaya weeps not just for her financial loss, but for the destruction of something beautiful that cannot be measured in rubles. Her grief affirms that some values exist beyond economic calculation: beauty, memory, connection to place, even as these values prove insufficient to save the orchard. This tension between inevitability and resistance creates the play's distinctive tone, neither purely tragic nor comical, but a uniquely Chekhovian blend that reflects life's fundamental ambiguity. We laugh at the characters' impractical responses while simultaneously admiring their refusal to reduce everything to profit and loss. The play's final act unfolds in the nursery where it began, creating a circular structure that emphasizes both change and continuity. The room is now stripped bare, with luggage piled in corners and furniture covered in sheets. As the family prepares for departure, each character reveals their plans. Renovskaya returning to Paris despite her lover's betrayal, Gaev accepting a bank position he's clearly unsuited for, Anya and Trofimov heading to Moscow with revolutionary dreams, Varya taking a housekeeper position with a distant family. These departures create a bittersweet atmosphere of endings and beginnings. "Goodbye, house, goodbye, old life," Anya calls out, to which Trofimov responds, "Welcome, new life." Their youthful optimism contrasts sharply with the older character's sense of loss. When left alone, Renovskaya and Gaev embrace and weep quietly, not wanting the servants to see their grief. "My dear, dear, precious cherry orchard," Renovskaya says in her final speech. "My life, my youth, my happiness. Goodbye." The most devastating departure is the one that doesn't happen. Furs, the elderly servant who has devoted his life to the family, is accidentally left behind in the empty house. Ill and confused, he lies down on the sofa, murmuring, "They've forgotten me. Never mind, I'll sit here a while." His abandonment represents the human cost of social transition, the loyal servants of the old order discarded when they're no longer useful. As Furs lies motionless, possibly dying, we hear two significant sounds, First, a distant noise like a breaking string, the same mysterious sound heard earlier in the play, and then the rhythmic thudding of axes against cherry trees. These sounds mark the definitive end of an era. The breaking string suggests connections severed beyond repair, while the axes represent the unstoppable forces of change transforming the landscape. Yet the play doesn't end in complete despair. In the distance, we hear the sound of an approaching train, a symbol of modernity, connection, and forward movement. This final image captures the play's essential balance. Something beautiful is being destroyed, but new possibilities are simultaneously opening. The cherry orchard falls to make way for summer cottages, aristocratic leisure yields to middle-class vacationing, one Russia dies while another is being born.